It just keeps falling more. All right. Don't worry about it.
All right.
I'm not worried.
Welcome to the Crafty Coders Podcast, the second podcast, Podcast Do, as we like to say. I'm Eric Moore. I'm here with Chris Albrick and Matt Chandler again for the second. And today, or this evening, whatever it is in your viewing vicinity, we're going to be talking about Entity Framework, Link to SQL, and then Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4.
Nice. So, all right.
How's it going, guys?
All right. It's going
very, very good.
Good.
Good. Reminder to everyone, if you have a question for us, any of us, about programming or about the podcast, you can send an email to podcast@craftycoders.com. And you can send it text, audio, whatever floats your boat.
If they do send audio, we'll put them on here.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's absolutely cool. You'll get to be on the Crafty Coders podcast. Your voice will.
Quite an honor.
I know. Yeah. That would be pretty awesome.
People are clamoring right now to their keyboards.
I didn't remind people.
Well, to their microphones.
Yeah.
That too.
Yeah.
All right. Send questions. .NET specific, I think, would be something we could answer.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Or about us.
Yeah, exactly. Other than that, we may just ignore you.
Probably. Yeah.
It's quite possible. Okay, so Entity Framework. Ready, go.
I love it. I hate it. Matt wins.
All right, next topic.
It's going to be a little shorter than last week.
This podcast will be 3 minutes.
Chris, why don't you start out?
All right. The Entity Framework, Link to SQL, is Microsoft's version of a ORM. What is that? An object
relational model?
Relational model, mapper, something like that. As far as I'm concerned, it's a good way for you to basically wizard your way through some code that's going to interact with the database and give you, for the most part, entity objects, kind of like business type objects that you can interact with your interface layer, and not worry about having to link everything back to the database.
It's object relational mapping.
All right. I'll try to clean that up a little better.
Well, now you don't know what you're talking about. I thought this was something totally different.
For the people out there that right now are doing, like we are for many of our projects, where you're separating out, you're doing like an interior development, and you've got your database layer. We do the data transfer objects, the DTO layer, and then your business objects. The ORM kind of wraps all that into one.
Yeah.
And you get this business object that also knows how to interact with the database, create itself, save itself, update itself, those sort of things. Yeah.
You just implement your own business logic.
Right.
For that.
And
which Entity Framework makes fairly easy.
I do believe so. It's interesting because we've been taught to separate out that database layer, that database access layer, with the business object layer. And when you get looking at the Entity Framework or Link to SQL, you have to decide, okay, well, I'm actually going to make these guys very ultra aware of where they're coming from. In the instance of Link to SQL, it can only interact with SQL Server. So you're not kidding yourself that how it's going to interact with the database or how you're going to get your data.
But I think that's a reason not to tie your business logic into it.
Okay. Expand a little bit better.
I don't want to. I would say you should have a service layer that is like your core, your business logic, mm-hmm. and maybe your core models, aside from Link to SQL or Entity Framework models. And then your Entity Framework or your Link to SQL layer should reside in a more repository layer where you're actually getting the data.
All right, this will be good because this will be where me and Matt disagree.
Because then, say you want to come in and your whole application is going to be driven off of XML files. Then you have all of your models that are specific to that that domain mm-hmm. and all your business logic the same, your repository is going to change. And then if you code to interfaces correctly, you should be able to switch those two out without having to modify anything in your service layer, thus not having to modify anything in your GUI or your presentation layer.
We're probably real close to the same. I think of how we do our stuff now.
Yes.
And we have that DTO object that we just pass in information back and forth, and our business objects basically replicate the property structure of that DTO object. Where what I like about the Link to SQL or Entity Framework is that you don't have to have that repetitive coding. You've got this entity. It's going to have all your properties on there. And then you can use partial classes, which may be what we're saying here. And what I like to do is say, okay, I'm going to go get my model from the database. And I'm going to generate my entities. And all right, I've got my entities out here. I know how to retrieve data, save data, update data to the database. Now I'm going to generate some partial classes that are still going to be those entities, because I don't really want to go back through the step of recreating just access to those properties. It does tie it really close together, but it also speeds it up quite a bit, which is, I think, that's the reason for going to...
There's probably a give and take there.
Yeah, but when we look at going to Link to SQL or Entity Framework, I mean, we're looking at trying to speed up, you know, get more to this rapid development type scenario. Or not. What do you think?
I don't think so.
Let's preface this with, I think we've both developed applications that use Entity Framework. I don't know if you've done any Link to SQL specific.
No.
And I don't, we may talk about this later. I don't know that there's a ton of difference between the two.
No, I don't think there is, besides the fact that you can work with many different providers using Entity Framework.
Right.
Obviously, whereas Link to SQL is tied to SQL, Microsoft SQL Server.
But if you're going to decide to go to... what I was going to say is neither one of us have actually supported or developed anything and supported it at work where we're dealing with the day in and day out. It's all kind of on private, homegrown stuff where, you know, not as big of a deal. But for me, if I'm going to start to develop something in the Entity Framework, I'm just going to let those entities that are created be my business objects. Tell me why you wouldn't do it.
What?
Yeah!
No,
point me.
No, I think that I wouldn't like tying anything to a specific data provider.
So would you say then, let's do that, the common design of, or you know, the common, I don't know, layout that you do for these test projects where you've got a customer and order objects.
Okay.
So customer has orders, blah, blah. If you go and you design your database and you've got a customer table and you've got an order table and say order details. So you go open up the Link to SQL Entity Framework and you go generate me my entities, and you get them out there, and so now you have that relationship defined. Are you saying you're going to add an extra layer on top of that? So you're going to have
and it would be some duplicate code,
right?
Because your models that you create for your application would be very similar to what Entity Framework generates for you from the database. But I'm kind of torn on that too, whether just to use the entity models that Entity Framework creates for you and use those, which is probably it's a valid way to do it.
But I
think if you're doing a large scale application, it's probably not the best route to go to tie everything directly to those entity models.
My thought is, with the use of partial classes, you get that separation. If you were going to change where your data was stored, you could go through and create a whole new entity model to actually get the database interaction between them and not lose anything if those partial classes still contain the business logic that you need.
Yeah.
So
true. It's, and it really probably is this pretty similar way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, it really depends, on how big this application, how big do you think this application's really going to go? Do you think there's going to be multiple providers in the future?
True.
Because I think that there's probably, you would probably want to try to steer a little bit clear because of that, because it would provide a faster development if you do have to change providers.
If you have to change providers that actually have a ton of column changes, I would agree with you. I've not been in a situation where you have to go through and say, okay, I was working on Oracle and I'm going to SQL Server. So it's hard for me to imagine what that entails.
Okay, I see it. Yeah, that's probably a valid point for if you're really tied to something, a certain database wherever you're developing this application at, then it's probably not bad. But let's say you're creating, and this is really probably throwing it off topic from what we've been talking about, but let's say you're creating like a blog engine,
right?
That has to, that say is going to support SQL, MySQL, whatever other databases there are out there. That's where you really want to separate that out,
and
you
want to have a little.
Exactly. But I don't think that's such a, it is a little bit more work and it's probably overkill for some things, but I think that that model is, should be, you should aim towards something like that every time, and it would help in the future, like when we have to switch from, you know, one big accounting financial database to another.
Very true. All right, now talking about it, you know, talking about what they do between the two, if you were going
to
say,
link to SQL in any framework,
do you have a preference, or would you give anybody who has not went in and started doing any of this, would you say, hey, start with this one or start with that one?
The small amounts that I've actually worked with it, I don't even see much of a difference. But I haven't done in-depth stuff. I mean, you're using Link,
right?
And whatever language you're doing, and probably C#, which is what we work with,
right?
And the Link is this pretty much the same between the two. Yeah, I mean, so you're really right. You're right. You're right in the same syntax.
Yeah.
It's just if you know you're going to be going against SQL Server, is there really a reason to want to go to Entity Framework over Link to SQL?
I think, in my mind, the reason you would is because there is no difference, or there's such very little difference. I think the main differences between Link to SQL is that in any framework, Link to SQL is SQL Server only.
Mm-hmm.
So if your database isn't SQL Server, then already your decision's
made. Yeah, your decision's made. Now, well, or you could go with a third party.
True.
Like I think the most popular one in .NET is in Hibernate.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost, I almost see more stuff on that than I do Link to SQL and Entity Framework. It seems like it's more popular, but I think it's been around for, you know, Microsoft's pretty new to the game as far as Entity Framework goes.
Yeah, it just came out, what, around
3.5.
Yeah.
SP1. I mean, so that was real recent, so.
And they're just talking about releasing, I guess, a beta for EF4.
Yeah, EF4. EF4, the second version.
Funny. I think the second version. The other reason I would say you would steer clear of a Link to SQL would be that although it's not dead in the water that's been reported, I don't think that you're going to see any big feature sets coming up from it.
Yeah, pretty much I think they've said that they're going to make changes to fulfill customer requests.
Yeah.
And then obviously bug fixes, any bug fixes, they'll make changes. But yeah.
And I think if you're going to see anything drastic or, you know, something fancy new that you go, okay, that would be useful, it's going to be in an Entity Framework. And if you're starting out, if you go, wow, that's a really neat feature I'd like to use, but is it worth converting all my stuff from Link to SQL to Entity Framework? But if you start out in any framework, then I think you'd be in good shape.
Yeah.
But yeah, there really are very few differences between the two.
Yeah, when you get down to simpler stuff, simple apps, you're not going to see a big difference. Now, the one of the cool things, and going back to any framework for a second, that we were talking about this today, is in EF4,
right, with
Visual Studio 2010, you can create an entity model on the visualizer and create a database from that model.
No, that is
which is pretty cool.
Or one of the things I saw coming out, you could also have just your objects that you've already created and create a framework around them to do the entity framework type information without even having to be in a database. You know, they're going to put that code around it.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I think we did at our work, we did a study earlier this spring, and we were trying to decide if we should take one of our projects into use Entity Framework, and we ended up deciding no, but for a very odd reason, and it was because we used composite keys, and the Entity Framework didn't play very nicely with those.
Yeah, it does support them, but the way they were used
it wasn't going to work well for us.
But I don't know much about that.
Other than that, though, I think we're sold on as being developer side. We like it. We think it would speed up, and it makes it a little easier.
Yeah, I mean, I love all the link stuff, whether it be linked objects or linked to SQL or linked to entities. That it's, and we'll get into more about the future of link stuff when we later in the podcast. But it makes it so much nicer to write your database layer when you're writing link statements against a entity framework or link to SQL.
It makes
as
it
a
nicer.
C# developer and not a DBA, I like it better.
No, and as soon as you start reading the syntax and it becomes more familiar, it even makes it more readable. But speaking of the DBA, and you know, we got Eric in here. One of the I think that's going to be the hardest sell for people to convince their companies, their bosses, of what to do. And we may not have described it. If you're not sure of really what the Entity Framework's doing behind the scenes, is you're mapping a database model to some C#. They're not they're C# classes, or I guess .NET classes. I don't .VB.NET, but you're mapping them to some code classes, and you get to do stuff like link queries from them. So you could say, give me from C and customer.orders, and get all the orders.
Yeah.
And what it'll do is it will take this link statement that you've built, and once you're finally ready to execute it, it builds the SQL automatically on the backside. Now, I know a lot of people, rightfully so, with Microsoft, have become distrustful of, what kind of code is Microsoft writing on the back end.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I think the queries have been proven to be, mainly like what people would write normally. Yeah. Some other instances.
And you can see what they're generating. There's ways to see the SQL they're generating. And
there's ways to override it.
And there are some people, like Jeff Atwood of Stack Overflow was talking about in a podcast. I don't think it was their own. I think it was on Scott Hanselman's podcast. He interviewed the developers for Stack Overflow, and they use link to SQL, which I found pretty surprising,
right?
Because it's a very large website. They use link to SQL for their back end, and he said they still had a lot of SQL statements that they wrote by hand and SQL, because they needed the performance, maybe, or they thought that, or they felt that they could do it in a more efficient way, which is a valid point.
Well, and that's one of
but it allows you to do that.
That's one of the things to talk about is performance. I mean, the
framework
is slower than if you're writing standard stored procedure calls against a database. Yes. But
there's also ways to, you can compile your queries beforehand, which will speed up.
It will.
The execution times in the future, because it doesn't have to compile it. So,
but you're still going to be slower.
It's still going to be a little slower, yeah.
And then I think the biggest hurdle you'll have to get over in with your company is the security issue.
Yeah.
I know everything we've developed right now, we use stored procedures because we don't want a user to have direct access to the table. And then a DBA can improve what that stored procedure does and that it can only modify the data in a certain way.
Yeah.
To get full benefit, and you can use stored procedures in linked to SQL, but what you're going to end up doing is a lot of those joins are going to happen client-side or server-side.
Yeah, you might as well. Why even use linked to SQL if you're doing anything with stored procedures?
So. You're just making it more difficult. Yeah. But I think that's going to be the hardest thing. You've got to convince your DBA that, yeah, I need this powerful user that's going to be able to.
But I think if you have a good security model as far as keeping a user for that app, that
it is.
I mean, you're not giving people access to it.
But you know as well as I do that user IDs and security accounts are so hard to keep truly secret.
Yeah,
and
you could run into that without linked to SQL.
I agree. I'm not trying to argue against it because I would like to develop my next app using it.
Yeah.
All right. So, final thoughts. I mean, neither one of us have developed anything other than personal sites, but gosh, I mean,
which will be huge, though.
Huge.
I mean, we're gonna be millionaires off these.
That's what I'm saying.
If we ever work on them.
But it does. It speeds up the development time incredibly. If anybody hasn't used it, they owe it to themselves just to step through the wizard and make an entity model and see how easy it is to do it and do a couple queries because the code's simple.
I recommend everyone try it once.
Right. And not only that, it's getting better. I mean, we have, I think moving on to what's coming in .NET 4 and Visual Studio 2010, the Entity Framework 4, one of the things they are doing is they're improving the type of SQL they generate.
Yep.
Along with, and I still don't understand, and maybe you know better than me, you know, there's this big deal about having those plain old CLR classes, the POCO objects,
and
what that's supposed to do. And I guess being able to separate them out without having references to actual Entity Framework libraries.
Didn't we already talk about that?
I don't know. But that's one of the things that's going to be coming out.
Yeah.
You know, so it's going to do something for you.
Yeah. So yeah, Visual Studio 2010, .NET 4.0, currently in Beta 1.
Beta 1.
Which,
you've been using 2010, right?
I've been using it, since it came out. That was right after Tech Ed, I think.
Right.
Or was it before Tech Ed? I can't remember. It was sometime
May-ish. I think it was released right around then, yeah.
June? I can't remember. But I had a... Well, I'm running on Windows 7, too, so it's like...
Yeah, I agree with you.
Beta on a release candidate. Yeah. So I had some problems with it initially, but we were talking about this morning. I think it was related to my display drivers. It crashed them. Visual Studio, it would crash them all the time, but... I've recently got an update on my display driver and haven't had that problem, but there are definitely some issues in it, but you know, it is beta 1.
Absolutely.
And supposedly beta 2 should be out soon. I don't know. From what I've read, be soon, but no one's hinted at a date yet.
I don't think Microsoft ever gives you official dates. They just
and if
send an email that
most people don't expect the actual release until before first quarter of 2010, so probably spring. Late spring.
Of the highlights of it. The one thing to make mention is it's the actual Visual Studio. It's been rewritten in the WPF.
Yeah.
And which is interesting. I mean, it's nice. Always nice to know that Microsoft is using Microsoft products and not just
which I've noticed they're doing a lot of lately.
Yeah,
they're you know, the whole velocity caching system that we've been looking at and stuff, and that some of our personal sites will be driven off of in the future. It's written completely in WCF.
Right.
So I mean, they're really embracing their own technology, which is cool.
Which lets you know they really do stand behind it. You can feel if Microsoft is going to release something in it, then you can be pretty confident that you can.
Yeah.
I mean, especially something like, you know, Visual Studio.
Yeah, and I like the new Visual Studio 2010 so far. It's it really, I mean, it's not that big of a difference style-wise. I mean, there's a little...
I've looked at some of the stuff.
There's like a little bit of difference, but nothing, like, dramatic. Nothing like, you know, what they went to when Office 2007 came out compared to, like, Office 2003. It's nothing, like, dramatic.
I still don't know how to
but it is, it's a... Yeah.
Either.
Yeah. I couldn't find anything in either of them, so... it's a little bit different, but nothing that... Nothing where you can't find anything. Everything's still in the same place, just styled a little bit differently.
Right.
And but overall, it is nice. They kind of changed the styling on the IntelliSense a little bit. And
now, I did...
I wouldn't say it's better, but it's different, you know.
I like some of the things that they changed on the IntelliSense, where you can start typing, iEnumerable.
Give me something to type here. I'll
type iEnumerable.
iEnumerable, okay.
Normally, you would only get... iEnumerable, that's what it starts with. I think you're probably getting like four or five different listings.
I typed
because
IEN and I get ASCII encoding because it has an IEN, and then I get iEnumerable and iEnumerator.
So it's starting to match the IntelliSense to anything in the Word. So if you know just a piece of it, you're going to get it. The other thing is the camel casing IntelliSense. You can type the, if you know the camel casing, and I don't even know how I would. I guess, you know, maybe right line or something. You can do WL and, you know, capital W, capital L, and that should bring up, like, right line on, you know, like a console dot. I think that is, it'll take a long time or a little while to get used to, but once you do, I mean, it'll be one of those things you'll wonder how you lived without.
I don't know what you're talking about there.
Well, it's in there somewhere. I've read about it. I don't know how to exactly do it, but I have read something on that. Let's see, what else did they have in 2010?
Well, I like one of the new things in .NET 4 is, I showed you this earlier, was on their file class in System.io, they redid a lot of the methods to return iEnumerable.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. Supposedly they made them more efficient too. A lot of the file reading and file IO classes. But so exposing iEnumerable out, you can write link statements against directory structures, files, file contents. So you can read through files and search through files using link.
Which objects.
So which is pretty freaking awesome.
No, it is. Without a doubt.
Because I love link. I love link.
Yeah, .NET 4.0. I think the feature that I'm going to enjoy the most, we're both mainly coding, well, not mainly, but a lot of our applications are web applications. And in 4.0, you're going to be able to give static IDs. So it's not going to mean much to anybody unless you use master pages. And if you've ever used master pages...
And web forms.
In web forms, but hey...
What are those? Are those still around?
They're going to be around for a while. I think MVC uses master pages.
Yeah.
And it's still going to... I assume it displays it the same way.
I don't know how it does IDs and all. I can't remember.
I've got to imagine. I don't know. But anybody who's used master pages and then tried to use any type of client-side code...
Yeah, CTL 00 underscore page name underscore some random Microsoft-generated key. Or I don't know how they do it.
It's impossible.
Yeah, they give you complete control over that. So you can take it just to a little finer level, or you can take over complete control over the entire how the IDs generate,
it's going to make doing client side a little bit easier on the Microsoft
side. And I think probably everyone who's done web forms has probably requested that at some point.
So.
Because it's a pain in the butt.
Let's see. Now, what do you think about one of the other new things in 4.0 is going to be this dynamic object, dynamic type.
Yeah.
Where... I don't know that I can give a great audio description.
I don't even know if I could do that. I probably should have researched that.
Well, it would be like if you had, I don't know, let's say you had a dog object and a cat object, and they both had a method that was make sound. You know, so the dog will bark, the cat will meow. Well, you could have a dynamic object that just says, get me animal, and it'll return you dog or cat. You can just have this dynamic type that's going to be one or the other.
That's not... And I guess to expound that, because could use interfaces to do that now, but it doesn't do that until runtime.
Absolutely.
And not compile time.
Right. Yeah. And then just say animal.makeSound, and it'll do what it is. And it's strange to me because I can see where that's going to be useful. But I just don't know that I'm going to want to get in and read some of that code or support some of that code that is going to be difficult to understand what's going on.
Yeah. There's a reason we use a statically typed language, right? I haven't thought of, I haven't ran across anything where I'm like, man, I could use dynamic right here. I haven't come across that yet.
Right.
But when I was at Tech Ed in LA this year and I went to Anders' talk about the future of C#,
right,
he's the creator of C#, the kind of dynamic is that's the main drive behind C#4. Like C#1 was whatever they did in C#1. All the base stuff. C#2 was generics. They introduced generics, which absolutely, they was supposed to be in 1, I guess, but it got pushed back. So
making the language is hard.
Yeah. So and generics is, I don't know what I'd do without generic.
I agree.
Couldn't even code C#.
So, maybe I'll
decently
think the same
without,
way, but,
without right, generics. And then, C#3, Link.
Link and
was,
Lambda, yep.
Was the big thing. And then now dynamic is his big thing. And they did, he did show some interesting ways that if you were using Python, if you had Python libraries or Python scripts, you could plug those in using the dynamic keyboard and run them through C#.
Now, I do that is an interesting way to think about it. And I think that's just what it's going to be. I mean, you're going to have to start thinking out of the box.
Yeah.
But
I'm sure there's, once it gets farther along in beta, people will come out with some good ways to use it. But I just hope it's not overused for reasons that it's not meant for.
I understand why the old people no longer almost dip the microphone. I understand why old people just get outdated. It's not because they're not smart. They just get tired of learning something every 2 years.
Yeah.
I think I'll
get tired
of
people writing an extension method for a using statement.
You see it and it's neat, but it's always fun to write that stuff.
It's
just so difficult to come back in and actually support that stuff if you haven't been under this,
stay on the bleeding edge and do something that ends up only lasting for 6 months, and then you have all this stuff that's written and this technology that no one ever really wrote anything in.
And so Microsoft, I think, is pretty...
of course, that's a bad association with C#, because I don't see that happening, where...
I don't either, then even, we all thought Link to SQL was dead. Yeah. Now, it doesn't appear to be, but, what if you would have done all that, and then you find out, wow, they're not even going to support it anymore?
I think that's the reason it's not dead.
You're probably right. let's see, what other type of features do you got there?
All kinds of stuff.
Yeah, just throw one out there. I had them all written down.
You guys, we're gonna do a podcast today. Is that cool? you guys ready?
We're gonna record this one again tomorrow.
We'll just edit it to make
this
sound
is,
like we.
This is podcast beta.
We were prepared.
That's right. That is.
Yeah,
right.
We're like Google.
I'm trying to think. 2010. Let's see.
There's lots of new stuff.
F# is actually officially a language.
Yeah,
now.
It's actually included in and packaged in with Visual Studio, which I haven't used F# yet. But
I haven't either.
I've seen some pretty cool stuff using F#, but in most of the programming I do, I haven't had an application for it yet.
I don't think I've had a reason to go out and learn it. I'm not doing anything, because F# is supposed to be really good at that mathematical science type.
Because it's a functional language. It's really meant to do. You can do more scientific type methods. If you're going to write a web app, you're not going to use F#.
Right.
Or I'm sure there's someone that does. There's no point in it.
You hate that guy.
It has its applications. C# has its applications. F# has its applications.
Right.
And I don't think they're not meant to be just, you just decide on one and use it for everything.
Yeah. So there's that. Oh, you know what's neat? And I'm going to be interested to see how we implement this. But I guess this is, I don't know if this is a 4.0 or 2010. They kind of blend in my mind. But being able to take care or start handling multiple cores, that parallel processing.
Yeah, parallel processing. That was actually what I was going to bring up next. Yeah,
I think that is...
We were thinking parallel.
Nice. Right,
we already got the parallel processing.
All right, that one's done.
Wow.
All right, next.
To take care of multiple cores.
Yeah, and they did a lot of really nifty stuff with parallel computing and even with Link. P-Link? Plink?
Plink.
Plink.
You can
take advantage of these multiple cores, but I was going to say something else and I forgot.
Blink. You were going to talk about that. One of the things they're listing is the chart control, and that's a bunch of BS because you could go down and download that anyway. So I don't consider that new
chart control.
But it is very.
They added a control.
It was that one that you could add in, so it was already out there.
Oh,
and I've used it, and it's incredible. Just it's. Flat out incredible. Makes you want to chart everything in the world.
Yeah.
But I guess that's going to be, an official included thing. One that I'm pretty excited about and the 4.0 language. And at first I didn't like it because it took me back to my just standard VB6 days. Optional parameters.
Oh, yeah. That's a big thing, too. How did I forget about that?
When somebody told me about that, I was like, I'm not going back to VB6. And then somebody asked me how do you take care of that? I'm like, you overload methods. Of course you do. That's what you do. That's why we went to a real language.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, but don't you have like one master method that takes all of them? I'm like, well, shut up, bitch. and you know.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah. And basically that's what I'm doing. I'm making optional parameters and defaulting them in my overloaded methods. And so... I think
the optional
parameters
thing is pretty cool.
I think it is going to clean up some code.
It does, yeah.
It'll make it pretty
and
nice.
A big change, well, not a change, but a big thing is this, the C# 4 and .NET 4 will target a different CLR, whereas you had the common language runtime for .NET 2, and then 3.0 and 3.5 were built on top, and 3.5 SP1 were built on top of that. But you still targeted the 2.0 CLR.
Yep.
This will target a new
CLR. Not just additions.
But they do run side by side, obviously, just like 1.1 and or 1.0.1.1 or 1.1 and 2.0 did. But there's also some cool stuff you can do and. With running, with how they run side by side, as far as loading up two different assemblies, it works a lot better than it previously did when you load up one that targets the CLR 2.0 and 4.0.
I just didn't have experience with it, but
I never really did either.
I won't say it's good, but yeah, you should download the IDE. I think I'm going to. You haven't had your machine die yet, so I'd take that as a sign. Mine will last. All right, so finally, let me talk about the best money-making thing I've ever heard of.
This is our off-topic discussion, our recurring segment. We're going to try to do this recurring segment every podcast. It may switch out.
Every time.
This last week, we talked about podcasts we listened to. This week, off-topic discussion.
Off-topic discussion. Swoopo.
And it's not even new.
We're just horribly slow.
I'd never heard of it until the other day.
I don't think anyone. Well, obviously, some people have.
Oh, it is the most ingenious. I want to shake the guy's hand because
or punch him in the face.
No.
Get your money back.
For anybody who's not been to Swoopo, you go there right now.
Swoopo.com.
And you're going to see somebody selling a Sony LCD 50-inch TV for $12. And you're going to go,
well, it's them selling it. It's not even people selling it.
No, yeah,
it's
you're right. It's Swoopo themselves are selling it for $12. And you're like, well, that can't be real. And you wonder, you're like, what kind of scam is this?
Yeah.
Well, no, that really is only $12 for that TV. But before you get too excited, here's the deal. Here's the ingeniousness of this.
Don't start bidding uncontrollably.
The whole plan behind it is, if you look up there, Swoopo's an auction, and every time you bid, it increases the price by a predefined amount. So a lot of them are 12 cents.
12 cents is the most it goes, I think.
I think the most.
Some are 2 cents, though. Or yeah. Some are 1 cent, I think.
If you get down and you look at that LCD TV, it only goes up 2 cents. So you go, hey, I like that. That LCD TV for $1,204.
Hell yeah.
I want it.
I'll pay 2 more cents for that.
So you go $1,206. What this does is it says, all right, you now have the highest bid, and there's 10 more seconds left to bid. And you
adds 10 seconds, yeah.
Adds 10 seconds to
or a predetermined amount. 20, exactly. Some
yeah.
are 20 seconds.
Some of them are a little longer. And you're like, well, that's not so bad. 10 seconds, maybe I'll beat somebody.
Yeah.
But here's the kicker. You have to buy every bid. So if you want to bid on that object, you have to pay Swoopo, what is it, 60 cents it's, a bid?
Start, say, how much is it per bid?
I think it starts at 60 cents, but you have to buy them up front. So you buy 30 bids for 6 cents a piece, whatever that equals out to.
Yes.
You know, $20, and, whatever it is.
And if
close enough.
Close right. enough. We're
so,
programmers.
We all right, so me, Eric, and Matt, we all want the TV. I bid. I gave them 60 cents. Matt comes back and bids over me. Well, now I no longer can win. And I lost my 60 cents. That's I paid the bid. Every time I decide to increase my bid, I just pay 60 more cents. Now,
or you're not increasing a bid, you're bidding again.
You're right. You're increasing the price. But
you increase the
last...
price by bidding again.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you're not.
And you add time to
right,
it.
Exactly.
And I'm telling you, it's like crack. You can watch it, and you're amazed at all these people. If you go and do the math, and you look at, I mean,
so there is a predetermined end of the auction.
So
it's just
say.
That every time, like they say, let's say they very first put the TV on there, and they go, okay, here's our 52-inch Sony LCD for $12 or whatever it is, and this is going to end in 24 hours.
Right.
The first bid makes it end in 24 hours, and 10 seconds.
Okay.
And then the second one, and that's what I'm asking.
I don't think there is predetermined times. Sure didn't make it look like it.
I looked at it, and they have like 24 different auction types, and they're really strange. There's the 1 cent auction. There's the you can not have any auto bid guys. I don't know. There's a ton of them. But essentially, we looked yesterday at a MacBook Pro. The going price for it was about $150? No, $180.
Something like that. It was ridiculous, yeah.
$180 when we looked at it. And over 4 or 5 hours, it went up $50 more. So $230. And I think the increments were 2 cents. And so we looked at how much they made just in the bids that we watched from 180 to 230. And you'd get 60 cents a bid. And I don't know, what was it like?
They made a couple $1,000s off those bids.
Right.
Yeah.
Enough to cover the MacBook.
Sure, easily, yeah.
So, yes, somebody does get it.
Somebody wins it, and somebody gets a great deal, and a whole bunch of people
lose like $5 or $10 a piece.
Probably more than that. Yeah.
No, it's amazing. You look at the total number of bids on some of these things, and it's ridiculous.
But there is a little bit of a sunny side to Swoopo.
can run out of bids.
You can lose all your money and live on the street. No. And they do call it entertainment shopping, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
it's more like gambling. You know.
Yeah.
It's perfect for gambling addicts that don't want to leave their house and they can't do online gambling anymore.
Yeah.
So,
how do you spell Swoopo? Is that Swoopo?
That is it.
Swoopo.com, yeah. If you want to buy a product, like say that MacBook was like $1,200 or $1,300, and you want to, and you go in saying, hey, I want to buy a MacBook, and it's $1,300.
Right.
They're selling it for $1,300. So you're like, I'll bid on it. Because what happens is after you start bidding,
that's only on certain auctions.
Oh.
That's not on everyone.
Well, make sure it's the right auction first. But you can, buy that for the price that they're asking minus the amount you spent bidding at any time during the auction on auctions they have marked as that. So
yeah, no. I guess if you wanted to take a chance on that, it might be worth it. But I don't know. It's just fun to watch.
Yeah, it's fun to watch. I'm never going to try it. But
the guy's ingenious. Whoever decides to do that.
They're millionaires,
it's
too.
One of those ideas where you go, man, why didn't I think of that? Yeah, it's so simple.
So I'm going to make a link to SQL project with .NET 4.0 And I'm going to try to rip people off.
Right. It was like a class project. And the next thing you know.
All right. So we did that one a little quicker.
All right. Yeah.
And that was a lot faster. And guys, again, the website is craftycoders.com. If you want to send a question in, whether it's just text or if you want to send an MP3, heck, if you even want to send us a video.
Or pictures.
Yeah, pictures.
Girls. I'm sorry.
Wow. You can send it to podcast at craftycoders. Podcast at craftycoders.com. And then we'll be back next week. Do we have a guest next week or not? We don't know, do we?
We don't know.
We have no idea what's going on next week.
It's exciting.
Once again, it's Chris Albrecht and Matt Chandler, and I'm Eric Moore. And thanks for listening to the second podcast for the Crafty Coders.